a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. Those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guests are Antonia Nelson and T.C. Boyle. My first guest is Antonia Nelson. She teaches creative writing at the University of Houston and is the award-winning author of three novels and four short story collections. Her stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, and Best American Short Stories. She is, as I said, she has won awards, the Flannery O'Connor Award. She's been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. She was awarded the Mademoiselle Short Fiction Prize, on and on. Very hardworking fiction writer and wonderful, wonderful writer. Let's bring her on to talk about her most recent collection, Some Fun, Stories and Novellas, published by Scribner. Hi, Antonia.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I have followed your work for such a long time, it seems. It seems like it's been years, and I always see you in the most wonderful publications, your short stories, and it seems like the hardest thing, actually, to get into some of these publications, at least, you know, from the point of view of many short story writers who try The New Yorker or try, you know, whatever, any of them. And talk about perhaps your journey to actually being successful as a short story writer.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, my impression at the beginning was that somehow making that first contact and success would lead to just doors opening automatically, and that was so not the case. And I think that's a good lesson for an artist, that, you know, the process of art is always the same. You completely doubt what you're doing, and you have no confidence of success. And I don't think that's a bad thing to learn very early, because the real joy in the process is the process, and the ultimate satisfaction of publication is always somewhat disappointing. And I don't mean that to be, you know, discouraging, just that if you enjoy the process of making the thing that you're making and doing a good job of it, that truly is the best pleasure. That said, I you know, had a story very early on published in Mademoiselle, and I thought that meant that I would continue to have doors opening ahead of me, and it was very not true, and it was a big disillusionment, but maybe a useful thing to encounter early, so that later successes always came, you know, with a big piece dose of reality attached. You know, I still really treasure the short story as a form, but it is not a form that anybody particularly wants you to write in, unfortunately.
Well, talk about this collection, Some Fun, and and putting together these stories in the novella that are in it. Did you have to leave a bunch out? I mean, is it sort of a process of which work together as a book and which go?
Yeah, to some extent it is. I do feel like there are stories, you know, at the moment I was writing them, I was fairly confident I would be successful with in some form or other. And then, you know, they turned out to be stories that were just necessary for me to write, but not necessary for me to publish and not necessary for anyone else to read. So those stories were ones left behind, maybe in the way that musicians who play beautiful concerts have to practice, and in advance of performing that amazing concert, the practice material is flawed in some way, but completely, you know, completely necessary to making a good concert. So I think there were a fair number of stories I jettisoned in favor of ones that worked out better. But if I hadn't written those losers, the you know, sort of relatively successful ones wouldn't have come about.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to determine that in choosing what you put in a collection, and that there's this kind of nice vetting process that goes on where you send your work out to magazines, and if a number of them reject you over a number of years, you can pretty well determine that story maybe is, you know, not meant for this public exposure, and you should shelve it and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So to some extent, that's kind of the process of finding a collection.
Yeah, well, you said earlier that no one really wants you to write short stories.
No one does.
And I'm assuming you're talking about, say, an agent or an editor as opposed to readers.
I'm actually not entirely. I teach classes on the short story, and what I've really figured out over the years of sort of studying the difference between the novel and the story, I mean, what I am curious about or interested in or confused by or was, anyway, was that, you know, the short story is a form that seemingly would be quite acceptable to a reading public who is not only, you know, on the short attention span part of our continuum of attention spans. We're very hurried. We're you know, rushed a lot of the time, and so the shorter thing would seem to be more preferred. And I don't actually think that's true. And I tried to research that in some way. You know, like why. Do people prefer novels? And I don't think it's exclusively because they get involved in these larger worlds. I think to some extent novels promote, they have happier endings in general because novels in general are about groups and you know, they take on larger elements of society. They are about community, and communities survive even as individuals perish. And stories are typically about individuals, and you know, the story of an individual is that finally the individual perishes and dies. And I don't think people are ready to accept that news, or at least to want to read about it. And so, I mean, I'm only making this kind of abstract, larger argument that perhaps stories are more depressing because they deal with individual characters whose fates are their mortality is, you know, their problem. And novels usually are about groups, and cultures and groups survive even as individuals within them, you know, do not. But the larger organization continues on, and I think people are more, you know, they want to hear that news, and I don't actually object to that as news. I still happen to love the short story despite all that. But I do understand why, in general, the public does not really cherish the short story in the same way.
Yeah. Oh, well, first off, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with Antonia Nelson. Actually, Antonia's in Vermont at a writers' conference teaching.
I am.
And at Breadloaf, at the most wonderful writers' conference on the East Coast, and perhaps anywhere, I might venture to say, in the U.S. But she's on the line, and we're talking about Some Fun, Stories in Novella, published by Scribner. I have to say that makes more sense in terms of how the short story and novel differ than anything I probably have ever heard. because it's so true. A short story, you have, you know, a few characters at most.
Yeah.
And maybe one major character. And novels, yeah, are much wider in scope. And that's just a really interesting way of putting it.
Well, I mean, many stories are that kind of coming-of-age story, and coming-of-age is always the drift from innocence to experience, and by extension, innocence is, you know, the lack of knowledge about what happens next, and experience is, you know, here's the deal. And you know, we never want to know it, but it's inevitable that we end up knowing it, and that equals, finally, some sort of sense of mortality. All this said, I still really, really adore the short story form, and there are so many writing programs and so many places where it is celebrated. It still is astonishing to me how, I don't know, how limited there is an audience for it finally out in the world.
Well, I certainly know a ton of people that read them, and you know, when you come across a short story that really works, you just sometimes is nothing better. Really,
I totally agree. It's a beautiful form.
Now, at the beginning of your book, you have a quote by Flannery O'Connor from "A Good Man Is Hard to Find," and O'Connor, so much of her work dealt with these, you know, misfits of characters and death and all sorts of things that are difficult to read about. And tell me why you have, this is one of the first quotes in your book.
I'm very attracted to O'Connor's sense of humor. I feel like I have very little affiliation with her, except just really appreciating, you know, her kind of gritty realism, mm-hmm. coupled with this peculiar, or to me peculiar, religious fervor. She's got, you know, she's not like me in many ways, but the way that I hope to sort of borrow from or just, you know, pay tribute to is her terrific dry wit. And she's just got these great characters who get to utter these terrific lines. But the line that this character utters is, you know, she would have been a good woman if there'd been somebody there to shoot her every moment of her life. And, you know, I think that's true of so many people. push coming to shove, you can be a good person, but until push comes to shove, until there's a gun at your head, perhaps you're not going to be the best human ever. And I think O'Connor's, she gave a series of lectures and has a very fine essay collection about her own work. Called Mystery and Manners,
yes.
In which she explains things. And one of the things she explains is that her characters are often driven to violent means in order to express themselves because they're just so hard-headed. They won't be revealed or challenged sufficiently unless it comes to a violent situation. And then they will prove who they are. And, you know, what they prove is that they are good people, finally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Once everything else has been pared away.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was interesting to learn about her. I think when I was reading her years and years ago, I didn't realize that she was a devout Catholic and went to Mass every day. And
yeah.
And and this was her fiction and her way of dealing with, you know, morals and ethics and
yeah.
art.
Yeah. And utterly unwilling to just pay lip service. She was really challenging to the Catholic faith. And, you know, I can go along with anybody who's going to truly challenge an institution and say essentially what is really at stake here. What's the real deal? And she's very good at that.
Yeah. Will you read to us from some fun?
I would be happy to. I thought I might read the first couple of pages of a short story called Strike Anywhere, which features a young boy and his dad in Montana. And I might just preface it by saying that my family has some homes in this fictionalized town, and that it is a town that Richard Hugo wrote about quite famously in his poem Degrees of Gray in Phillipsburg. And anyhow, this story is about a little fictional town based on that. It's mm-hmm. called Strike Anywhere. This was the next time after what was supposed to be the last time. The father parked at the curb before the white front, and the boy found himself making a prayer. It was Sunday, after all, and this was what his mother did when faced with his father's stubborn refusal to do what he said he'd do, or not do what he said he'd not do. Please, God, and God knew the rest. Don't move a muscle, buddy. You hear? The boy nodded, afraid to look at his father. His father could find accusation in any expression turned his direction. He sat small on the truck bench seat. His father had inclinations like a dog, like a bear. He pounced on motion, a little witlessly. Just as the truck door creaked open, the bar's sign flashed on. His father, climbing out of the vehicle, grunted as if answering the neon light. A vivid imprint of the beckoning white letters burned into the boy's mind. Not one inch, his father reminded him, looming at the window before locking the truck door, slamming it and crossing the sidewalk. He slapped the wallet in his back pocket, cinched his hat, drew breath to make himself tall, and disappeared through the dark entryway of the bar. The boy's name was Ivan, and he was 8 years old. He had been sent on this errand to prevent just this sort of thing from happening. His father had quit drinking 3 months ago. Today they had gone to the Sunshine Station on the highway for lighter fluid and stick matches. His mother was home with the other three children waiting to ignite the barbecue. It was 5 o'clock on a Sunday in May in Portersburg, Montana. The snow had melted and the grass had popped up, bright green and bent, as if it had been blanketed all winter, waiting. The boy's mouth watered for venison. They had thawed a few steaks to celebrate spring, to congratulate his father's sobriety. His mother had fixed cowboy beans, and his big sister had made marshmallow whipped cream maraschino cherry fruit salad. Soft white dinner rolls you could squeeze into doughy spheres the size of eyeballs and poke all at once between your lips. The meal shimmered like a mirage, like a hunger. Main Street bustled in the welcome warmth of the day. Finally, it was time to step out. People dawdled on the sidewalk rather than plowing against a frigid wind. They had removed their coats so that you could tell who was who, the men from the women, the strangers from the locals. At Ivan's house, his mother had pulled the plastic from the windows this morning, a ripping, unzipping. Every winter, the family grew accustomed to looking through the blurry, insulating wrap. Then spring arrived, and the house, like the people, shed a layer, stood naked and clear. They lived next door to the police station and jail. With the windows open, you could eavesdrop on the dispatch radio, the funny codes the police used to mean one sort of mishap or another. 911, Ivan's sister Leanne said whenever she spotted their father's truck rolling home late and slow. That's a big 10-4. You can just call us at 1-800-JERK-OFF 24/7. What, Ivan wondered, had made his father come to the white front today? He felt both responsible for his father's bad decision and completely irrelevant to it. A few years ago, the grocery had been located downtown, a mere 3 blocks from their house. If it hadn't moved to the highway, wider aisles, more parking, bakery, and ATM, then Leanne would have been sent on foot for the forgotten supplies, perhaps Ivan himself. The whole town might be said to have conspired in his father's fall, guilty cause of this effect, or not. The truck cab was neither too cold nor too hot. That simple fact could have been the one that had decided his father. Gentle spring weather. It would be safe to leave his son sitting in it for however long necessary.
Thank you so much. That was Antonia Nelson reading from Some Fun, Stories and a Novella, published by Scribner. I'm curious how this story began, and in general, how do your ideas find their way to becoming stories or novels?
Well, my first premise, I think, is sort of a lucky one for me, which is that I conceive of everything I encounter as being a story. I don't have any notion that it has to expand to something larger, that I'm wasting time or something on smaller ideas and in anticipation of some larger one coming somehow. So I'm really so dedicated to the form that I'm happy with a short story idea should it arrive. But mostly I think I wander around hoping that there's something in the world that strikes something in me, and I often think of it as something like a lightning strike, where it's really not random. There's something that attracts lightning from the sky. There's something in the landscape that speaks to something in the writer, and that, you know, that intersection makes for a potential piece of fiction, something that can be out there and inside at the same moment. What drew me to the material, I think, in that particular story was a student's having written a story that had no relationship whatsoever to do with my story, but when she came and had a conference with me after her story's workshop, she began to weep and began talking about her brother and, you know, essentially handed me a kind of very vague plot line, which really appealed to me and which I removed from her setting of El Paso to Montana and a variety of other changes. But what I especially appreciated from my student was that she said to me, this is a story, I know it's a story, I can't write it, you should write it. She basically handed it over as a kind of gift or gauntlet challenge, I'm not sure exactly, but essentially she said, it's yours, you do something with it. And I liked that as a notion, and it moreover, just as a story, was attracting something in me in the way that, you know, something out there speaks to something inside.
Mm-hmm. What part do your titles play? At what point do they come for these stories?
Sometimes they come quite early. I was attracted for a while to the two-word title, you know, just phrases that seem to have kind of enigmatic or oxymoronic or, you know, just catchy, naked ladies or, you know, strike anywhere, just this kind of something title-ish about them that I was attracted to and then I built toward. And other times they come directly out of the material, something somebody says or some catalyzing, galvanizing expression that seems to not exactly summon up the point of the piece, but to focus one's attention on it when reading, just a little focus.
Mm-hmm. And then your novella in this book, Some Fun, was that meant to be a short story? And as you said, it just found its own length, and it wasn't quite a novel, but it belonged with the collection, and it became a novella.
That piece was about 10 years in the making, and I had assumed it would be a story, and then when it wouldn't conform to story length, I was reluctant to commit to a novel. And it was only maybe 8 years into the project, and I only mean that in working on it very sporadically, that it assumed its proper length. I hope its proper length. I don't know. But I think its proper length of about 100 pages. And then it was relatively fast to get it, you know, up to snuff in some way. It's hard to want to write a novella, I have to say. There's if people don't want you to write a short story, they really don't want you to write a novella. They would much prefer that it would look like something two or three times as long. So It was hard to commit myself to it because the commitment to a story is a briefer commitment, and this commitment to a novel is a more, you know, lucrative commitment. And the commitment to a novella is all about art. And you know, it's a little no man's land, I think.
Interesting. Well, I'm also, gosh, I have a bunch of questions, and we have about 2 minutes left, so let's see if we can fit them all in. Yeah. So you don't write stories straight through, then? I mean, it sounds like the novella took a matter of years, and I assume it was a short story at one point, and it kept going.
Yeah, and it kept getting backburnered, and then, you know, I would have other ideas that came up, and I sort of think of my writing process as being this huge computer screen of, you know, like people who play bingo religiously where they have a lot of cards, and so whenever a number is called, you know, the really committed bingo player has a number of places that particular call number could go, and I think of fiction and short fiction maybe particularly that way, that I've got a lot of files of stories that are possibilities, probabilities, places I have interest, and whatever strikes me out there in the world, maybe I can put it somewhere and make use of it.
Yeah, good way of putting it. Do you still get rejections?
Oh, all the time.
You do. See, yes. Most writers would think at a certain point, especially with novels and collections of short stories, that you would be beyond that.
No. Yeah. You know, I think the thing is, every time you start out to write something, you have the exact same experience is always the same. It's like, this is junk, it's obvious, everyone already knows this, I'm an idiot, I'm a hack, and, you know, it moves all the way from the beginning of the process to the excitement of feeling you may be on to something, to finishing it, to sending it out, to having no idea whether it's going to be accepted or rejected. I mean, it's precisely the same as it was 20 years ago when I was a graduate student studying this.
Mm-hmm. And will you just keep going with it and send it out till it gets placed?
I will, I'll finally eventually, you know, decide that perhaps I need to reinvestigate and revise and,
mm-hmm.
you know, start
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm. It's been just a delight talking to
you.
Well,
thank you very much.
I wonder if you have any words for the short story writers listening.
I would really just say, you know, that it's a tremendous art form and so demanding and rigorous, as demanding and rigorous as a poem. And, you know, with maybe the same kind of audience, a sort of list of very dedicated devotees who may not spend enough money purchasing collections, but nevertheless are, you know, true artists. And, you know, art is almost never about money. So
yeah, so true. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. That was Antonia Nelson speaking to us from Middlebury, Vermont, and her most recent collection is called Some Fun, and it's published by Scribner, and what a great writer. She truly is. Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will be here with T.C. Boyle, so don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Feel good folk and sassy swing music on the Hootenanny Swings with Toe Tap and Tawny
and DJ DR. Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live on KUCI.org.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Tari Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're back for the second half with T.C. Boyle, and he's been on before. It's always wonderful to speak with him. He's the author of 19 books of fiction, including The Tortilla Curtain, Drop City, Tooth and Claw, and most recently Talk Talk, which was just published. Received a Ph.D. in 19th century British literature from the University of Iowa in 1977, his MFA from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop in 1974, and he lives in the L.A. area. He's been published everywhere, and his books have been translated into just about every language. So let's bring him on, T.C. Boyle, to talk about Talk Talk. Hi there.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again.
Oh, what a pleasure and what a joy.
I love this book, I must say. I found out quite recently that you were indeed coming on the show today, and mm-hmm. so I wanted to read it before you came on, and I found myself getting so absorbed in it. It reminded me in so many ways of The Tortilla Curtain, actually.
Oh, what a wonderful comparison. By the way, was it a real slog to get through, sort of like when you last read Finnegan's Wake, or was it a little quicker than that?
I love this book. I love, yeah, when I read Finnegan's Wake. Oh, let me think of when. That was another life, I think.
You know, it's great that you should say that it reminds you of Tortilla, because in looking back over the books I've done since then, that was 95, I realized that this is my first contemporary setting since then. If you discount Drop City, which to me, of course, involved events that happened during my lifetime in the hippie era of 1970, but really it's an historical novel, so this is the first time I've come to address a contemporary issue or problem since The Tortilla Curtain.
Well, you know, that I'm so glad you said that, because that's what I was thinking. You were dealing in The Tortilla Curtain with immigration and people coming over the border and what befalls them. And in this one, you're dealing with another extremely current situation, identity theft.
Yes. I began researching identity theft, being suitably horrified by the various articles in the newspaper and the horror stories of just about everyone you talk to who's had something like this happen to them. And I was wondering, am I going to write a horror story? I mean, should Stephen King write this or me? Until I began to think a little more deeply about the idea of identity. Why are we so upset by someone impersonating us? And I think it's because it touches us in our deepest selves. Who are we really as individuals? We want to be recognized. There are 6.2 billion people in the world. We want to be important and be somebody in our own selves. So if somebody compromises that or impersonates you, I think it hurts you in a way even more deeply than if they rob your house or steal your car, for instance.
That's true. And And the way you're dealing with it, too. Well, I have to say, and without giving away the ending even, I was so curious how you were going to end this. Because, you know, a thriller or a mystery would end it one way. A mainstream novel, or I should say more commercial fiction, would end it another way. And I considered this a literary novel, and you ended it really quite perfectly. Did the ending just come to you, or did you struggle over which direction it had to go in?
No, all my work is purely organic, and it's all of one piece, and if it moves from day to day to the end, and the end just is discovered. Every story and every novel I've ever written. The ending of this one seems very appropriate to me, if you think about it, because it's the first time the two antagonists have communicated mm-hmm. verbally in the entire book.
Right.
And at that point, they each understand something. And I think it's a more elliptical ending than you would expect from a genre book, but of course I don't write genre books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using a story that might fit into a genre, a thriller. Of course, I've never read a thriller, so I don't really know, for my own purposes, and that is to bring you back into the book in the way that the ending of the Tortilla Curtain brings you back into the book to think about the themes of it.
Yes. So this book then, how exactly, I mean, did it begin? You said you started researching identity theft, but was there another genesis? Had something happened? Had someone said something to you and you were off? Or how? What happened there?
Wow, this sounds like a leading question. You probably heard me talking about this in other interviews.
Haven't. I really haven't
heard
any
wow.
interviews
well,
with you on this. Yeah.
Again, here I'd read all the texts about identity theft, what it is, how it happens, how to avoid it, how to clean up after it, et cetera, et cetera. But it really wasn't getting much beyond the surface, taking notes and meditating on it. You'll notice that in the first chapter, Dana Halter, our heroine, is going to her dentist. She's late, and she runs a stop sign. And at that juncture, the police go to check on their little computer and come back, guns drawn, and handcuff her and throw her in jail because, obviously, she's been the victim of identity takeover and someone is committing crimes in her name. Well, I had to memorialize my dentist in that first chapter because it was because of him that the light bulb went off in my head, and here it was. I went to him for, you know, the routine drilling, filling, and torture. and it happened that he'd recently been divorced, and he had a real eye out for women at that point. He said to me this, "My God, the most beautiful woman I've ever seen was sitting in this chair before you, and guess what? She was deaf." As soon as he said that, I began to meditate on this, even under conditions of duress, you know, the drilling and the filling and the thumping and all the rest, because I realized that if I were to study deaf culture and my heroine were to be deaf, then I could get a very special identity. Yes, we're all special, of course, but how we know who we are is through acculturation and through language, through the acquisition of language. We talk to ourselves and to each other. The deaf do the same, but they have a different culture and a different language, a visuospatial language as opposed to an auditory language. And so their identity is different from ours. All hearing people, no matter what ethnicity they are or where they came from, are of one culture, and all deaf people, again, no matter what their ethnicity or where they come from, are of a different culture. And so this opened up the entire book to me. Not only can I talk about a different kind of language, but you'll notice that in the course of the book, Dana herself, who was an English teacher teaching the deaf, has been deaf since childhood after a disease, she herself is writing a book, and this book is called Wild Child. And it's about the wild child of Aveyron, l'enfant sauvage, who was found mm-hmm. as a feral child in France in the Napoleonic era, captured, brought back to Paris. He was estimated to be 11 or 12. And despite the most patient teaching, he was unable to acquire language. And so the themes began to play out very deeply for me as the book evolved.
I love that. No, I haven't heard, you know, I think I purposefully didn't want to hear any of the interviews that have happened thus
good.
Far because, you know,
that keeps it fresher. It's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that.
Then we're contrived here. But I love that, and I love that she was deaf. And another thing I loved is that your bad guy, Peck, is a foodie. He is so totally into cooking. Where did that come from?
Well, I'm not a foodie, although people assume that I am because I wrote Sorry Fugu, a story about a restaurant critic many years ago, and it describes many exotic dishes. I am very close friends with some of the world's foremost foodies, and occasionally I will indulge in a little food with them, particularly when I'm in Manhattan. However, I don't make an obsession of it, and I think it's a little bit absurd to a degree in a world in which everybody's starving to death and we're all doomed imminently. Nonetheless, Peck makes the kind of dishes that I might make. And they're not really, I think they're mouth-watering and they're wonderful, but they're not really the highest class of haute cuisine. He thinks they are, of course. And I think that's a great way of identifying the character. Yes, he's a bad guy. He's a very bad guy, and we will be repelled to a degree by what he does. But in his own mind, he's just getting what's his due. That is, there's insurance companies willing to pay for these identity theft ripoffs. He's not really hurting anybody in his own mind. Meanwhile, he feels he's due to have the American lifestyle, the Mercedes, the beautiful Russian girlfriend, the condo in Mill Valley, right on Shelter Bay there. And he likes to just spend his afternoons, instead of grubbing for a living, going to the market in his Armani jacket, picking out nice ingredients and making a lovely little meal for his inamorata every night. It's basically what I do, by the way, in life, only I rip off people in a different way. I foist these horrible novels on them every year.
Well, you are just one of the most prolific guys around. Are you just so incredibly disciplined, or is it just is there a beat? Something happens. You just sit down every day. It comes out. You get up. You go. You come back the next day.
We've talked about this before, Barbara, and there are two things going on here. One, I had the great advantage of being born naturally caffeinated, and two, once I discovered what I wanted to do in life and what I could do in life, it's become a kind of obsession. Many listeners will know my essay, This Monkey, My Back, in which I talk about my origins as a writer. And as you can tell from the title of that essay, I compare the creation of art to a kind of addiction. I never know where any story will go or what it will be. I simply have an idea. I begin to see things and hear things, and I follow it. And I'm always on a tightrope, and I could fall at any moment. When I don't fall, when I do find what the ending is and complete something, I find a tremendous rush of exhilaration, which I compare to a kind of drug high. And, of course, you become addicted to that, and you want to feel it again. I've been lucky enough to discover a talent that I have and lucky enough to be able to pursue it. And so I want to pursue it to see where it's going to go. Every story to me is a complete adventure and a complete exploration, and it's hard to shut that off, which is not to say that it isn't difficult to work each day and that, like everyone else, I don't have this whole routine of avoiding work. Of course I do. But when I get into that phase when I'm not really aware of what's around me, the same phase the reader gets into on the other end of this, then I feel very good. I should say, too, that I enjoy talking to you at this very hour, which is my favorite hour of the day. My work has been done since about 3 today. I've been out in the yard, you know, digging things and cutting things and hauling things around and sweating. And now I've changed into some nice, clean clothes, and it's time to have a cocktail and go out for dinner. And I'm not cooking tonight.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T.C. Boyle. He's author of Talk Talk, published by Viking. And so much to talk about before he goes in 10 short minutes. But,
well, you know, people are really enjoying this book, and I think it's because of what you said earlier, that it reminds them to a degree of the tortilla curtain. My publisher wants to call it a thriller because that's a magic word somehow, and they think it'll sell more copies. But in fact, it's just another of my novels. Many of the stories that I've written in recent years follow this kind of mode. Yes, it's exciting. Yes, it's a wonderful read. I think all literature at the highest level should be a wonderful read. This one in particular, though, because it addresses a question people are very concerned about now, may have a little extra edge. I understand it's being very popular with book clubs because it's a good read, and it also gives people something to discuss, a subject beyond the book itself.
And you know, there's that thing called the log line, right, that you say just a few words about what a book's about, and it catches someone's interest, or it doesn't. But in this case, quite a few people have asked me what I've been reading, and I've said, Talk, T.C. Boyle's coming on the show. It's about identity theft, and they're writing down the name of the book.
Yeah, sure.
Because that line, it's about identity. I want to read that. Okay.
Well, I worry about everything all the time, and that's part of my function in society is to interpret things. I'm like anybody else. I'm reading the newspaper every day. I'm worried about the parlous state of the world, and this is one thing I wanted to address. I've addressed many, many issues. This is one that disturbs me, and now it hasn't happened to me quite yet, although you may know that the week before I went off on tour for this book, my most vulnerable time, someone hacked into the website impersonating the administrator and just to destroy it.
We all are
victimized in one way or another by this kind of crime.
Do you have a shredder?
I have had a shredder for many years. Not only do I shred, but then I burn. And by the way, the people who write the books about identity theft, to a man and woman, only deal in cash. And I think the most suspect times when you use your credit card are when you just give it to the waiter at the restaurant or you give it to the person at the gas station and go out and pump your gas. Because these are low-wage people. Often people at a slightly higher level of identity theft will pay them to just run your card twice through a skimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And the book talks about all of this, of
right.
course. The most likely way that you would have your identity stolen is someone steals your mail. And in many cases, they will simply, you'll be missing your mail for a day or two. And the Post Department, by the way, has become more hip to this lately, but that's only in very recent years. Prior to this, someone would simply impersonate you, go to the post office, any post office, and file a change of address. And by the time you realize you haven't gotten your mail for a week, well, they have every number and everything about you and have already ripped you off.
Mm-hmm.
This is a simple identity theft, and, you know, it's amazing. You say that you tell people what the subject is, and everybody is interested. Well, I'm running into a lot of people now, of course, out on the road promoting this book. Almost everybody has had an incident like this happen to them or to their brother or their dog or their mother or somebody. It's so pervasive. What's far more interesting to me in this book, though, is not simple identity theft, but identity takeover, which is what William Peck Wilson does to Dana, our heroine. He has been living as her. He likes her identity. Why would someone do this? Well, because their identity is compromised. For instance, in the case of William Peck Wilson, my bad guy, he has been in jail. He assaulted the lover of his ex-wife. He owes alimony. He owes child support. His business has gone bankrupt. He doesn't have a lot of skills or education. And so he becomes Dana Halter. She's got a PhD. She's got excellent credit. And he can walk around in Mill Valley in his Armani jacket, and people call him Dr. Halter, and he gives on that he's a medical doctor. And he really likes her identity, so much so that she is able to discover who he is and to track him down because he won't give her identity up when he should have.
Yeah, he can't stop, and he gets a little greedy there.
Well, I don't know if it's that he gets greedy, because his money is coming from other sources. That is a simple identity theft. The identity takeover thing, he just likes who he is as Dana Halter so much that he doesn't give it up when he should. He knows he should. If he were smart, he would have given it up. And then we wouldn't have had all these complications. But, of course, novels need complications. In fact, this one has a great chase all the way across the country, from Mill Valley to Peterskill, New York. And many listeners will know that this is the fictional name of the town in which I grew up, in New York's Hudson Valley, Peekskill, which was named after Jan Peek, the Dutch explorer who discovered it. Kill, of course, in Dutch, meaning creek or stream. So it is Jan Peake's Kill. And I just fudged it slightly in my book, World's End, back in 87, to remind people that this is fiction. So Peck comes from Peterskill, and he runs to it.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I have a few minutes left with T.C. Boyle, author of Talk Talk, published by Viking.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, by the way, speaking of Peterskill, we can talk about little Borgesian moments. I have been identified in one text very authoritatively as having been born in Peterskill, New York, rather than Peekskill. So the fiction is creeping into real life. And further, Dana Holter's novel, Wild Child, originally, in the original manuscript, was a 66-page novella that you could read in addition to Talk Talk as an appendix to it. My publisher talked me out of it, and I published it separately in McSweeney's. The current one, I think, is number 20. This would be number 19, so it has just come out a few months ago.
Oh, I've got to find that.
Many people are reading Dana Holter's Talk Talk, and at the end I had the great Borgesian fun of having an author's note, and it said to this effect that, you know, I'm represented as the author of this, but, of course, how could I have such insight into language and identity when Dana Holter had written it?
That's great. I'm going to have to search that one out. Well, I wanted to just ask you something that you had mentioned a little earlier, and you said you were talking about, I guess you're talking about the process of writing, the addictive process, and you said, when I find the ending. Can you say a little more about that? Do you know where you're going when you're writing? I mean, do you have an idea of where you'd like to arrive, and then you start getting a sense of how the ending is supposed to go?
Yes, sure. But I think if you programmed it beforehand, it would be too schematic and rather boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to find where you're going, and sometimes I may jump ahead and discover that. In my 1990 novel, East is East, about a Japanese immigrant
yes.
to America, I didn't know what would happen to Hiro Tanaka until the last page of the book. I was thinking about it intensely, and I think the day before I got there, I'd been done with work for the day. I was up in the mountains in the Sierras. We were heading down to the mighty Kern River, my wife and my three little children and I, to take a swim, and I had to pull the car over and wrote the last few lines right there. They just came to me at that moment because I'd been meditating on it for a long time. And incidentally, I'll spoil it for everyone who hasn't read the book, Hiro does kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I know we can't use bad language on the radio, but I'll substitute the word poop for the real word, okay? I got a letter from someone in Hawaii, and the person said, "How could you kill him off, you little poop?"
Oh, man.
And you mentioned Tortilla Curtain also. I arrived at that ending, which is a moment. It just is a moment, a symbolic moment. And I thought that I would have to go far beyond that. But when I got there and was writing it, I realized that this is where it must end.
Hmm.
And again, as with the ending of this particular book, I think it brings you back in. You think, well, what does that mean? Why is that the ending, you know?
Yes.
Rather than, let's say, in some of my historical novels, like The Road to Wellville, where you get an epilogue, and this is what happened to so-and-so, this is what happened to so-and-so. That's fun, too. They're all different sorts of endings. If there were only one kind of ending, I suppose I'd be writing genre books, you know?
Mm. Well, thank goodness you're not, and I always look forward to your new work and even to some of your old work that I want to go back and read The Tortilla Curtain again. And I just appreciate you, and thank you so much for taking the time once again to come on the show.
Barbara, what a joy it is, and I'm sure I'll talk to you before too long about the new one, which is about a quarter of the way done, and I think we will see it not in 2007, but in 2008.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was T.C. Boyle. He's author of Talk Talk, published by Viking, and just You gotta read this book. I mean, we're not allowed to tell people to go and buy books, so I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to say get a hold of it and read it soon, okay? Read it soon. It's just excellent, excellent book. Also, if you're writing fiction, you really need to read this and see how the man works a sentence, okay? You need to read it for that reason as well. All right, we're out of time. And if you want to know more about the show, you can visit my website at penonfire.com. We put up podcasts every week, new ones. You can find those by going to penonfire.com, clicking on the radio tower. And then there's roads, paths, byways to where we podcast and archive. I think that's it. I'm going to read you a real quick quote from T.C. Boyle's book, We Are Our Language, but our real language, our real identity, lies in inner speech, that ceaseless stream and generation of meaning that constitutes the inner mind. L.S. Vygotsky from Thought and Language. Thanks again for listening to 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, author of Pen on Fire. Until next time. Take care.